In this week's program, another collection of short stories from Cullum Thobeen. We discussed an earlier collection, Mothers and Sons, not too long ago. This one is called The Empty Family, an appropriate title given the amount of family tensions here and the manner in which we're invited to reflect on the meaning of home. The settings here vary from County Wexford to Barcelona. Occasionally, we glimpse the Cullum Thobeen of Brooklyn in those stories that straddle both Ireland and what we used to call the New World. Two of the Spanish stories have gay themes, one marked by tenderness, the other by more urgent needs. The third Spanish story, The New Spain, features a familiar Irish obsession, that of property. The title story, The Empty Family, stands out from the others in that it's less plot-driven, less character-focused. It's really a series of meditations, set by the sea at a spot where the protagonist can watch the ferry from Rosslare. It's the most reflective of the stories. Here's an extract from that title story.
I turned and moved fast, focusing swiftly on a wave I had selected for no reason. There was whiteness and greyness in it, and a sort of blue and green. It was a line. It did not toss, nor did it stay still. It was all movement, all spillage, but it was pure containment as well, utterly focused, just as I was watching it. It had an elemental hold. It was something coming towards us as though to save us, but it did nothing instead. It withdrew in a shrugging irony, as if to suggest that this is what the world is, and our time in it, all lifted possibility, all complexity and rushing fervour, to end in nothing on a small strand, and go back out to rejoin the empty family from whom we had set out alone with such a burst of brave, unknowing energy.
An extract from the title story, The Empty Family, read by Sean Rocks. With me, Julia Carlson and Morris Devlin. What did you make of this, Julia, of the collection as a whole?
I think it's a very interesting collection. It's a themed collection. It's a collection that deals with exile, really, and return. And the focus here, apart from in two of the stories, is almost entirely on the subject of return, of people who have left their homes, gone to make a life somewhere else, and who are now returning. And their kind of troubled relationship with home, such as it is when they return. These are stories which are filled with empty houses, empty homes, and the title, of course, Empty Family, relates very much to that. It's also, it feeds off Joyce in a certain kind of way, I suppose you could say, in terms of the subjects of silence and exile. Silence is a great subject in these stories as well, because these are stories about people who, in a sense, keep their own counsel, who don't speak, who don't communicate with one another. And in an interesting kind of way, that also draws attention very much to the whole subject of language in the stories as a whole. It's a very strong collection, and it's an interesting collection.
You liked it? As a collection. Morris Devlin.
Yes, I liked it very much, Andy, as well. And it's interesting that Julia draws attention to silence. Mm. Silence is, in fact, the title of one of the stories. An interesting story, one that kind of sits out on its own a little bit with Lady Gregory as the subject, Lady Gregory and Henry James, and the fact that she apparently gave him a donné, an idea for a story. And Thobeen here suggests that this is based on her actual affair with the poet Wilfred
Scawn Blunt.
Yeah. Mm. And so there's undoubtedly a strong element of imagination in it. But even though the denouement of the story, so to speak, is her telling Henry James about this scandalous episode in her life, what is most significant is how little she actually tells him.
Mm. She's ambivalent about whether she should tell the secret, or she's ambivalent about whether people should know about it or not. I think a lot of people can identify with that if they're involved in something.
Until it's acknowledged or until someone else knows about it, it's almost as if it hasn't happened for her.
Yes.
It hasn't a reality in her life. And she refers to what goes on between herself and Blunt as a form of emptiness itself. Yeah. Because it is unacknowledged.
So the ambivalence is highly credible, the ambivalence as to whether the affair is known about or not.
Well, she's very much afraid that she's going to be caught and that this is going to ruin her marriage, and that if she is caught, that her life is never going to be the same again, and that the secret could ruin her life. On the other hand, she has no friend to tell. She seems to be very isolated, to be very alone, a young woman married to a much older man who has very mixed feelings about the marriage that she finds herself in. And James, in a sense, becomes that friend to whom she tells her story without ever revealing that she's actually talking about herself. Tobin writes about how she had lodged her secret with him. She's been longing to have the relationship publicised in some kind of way, and Blunt publishes her poems as though they were his poems about the relationship. So I think that James is becomes the vehicle, in a sense.
Tobin talks about her as listener, and that how that takes more work than talking. The theme of silence in and also the silence, of course, that Scorn Blunt needed in his living quarters to write.
She's a character who, as Tobin writes, knows what not to say. Mm. And this is actually true of a significant number of the characters in the stories, that there's a great focus on the way in which, on tact, on the absence of intimate conversation.
Or touch,
mm-hmm. Yes, okay.
Very much, yeah. And in fact, in one of the stories, The Colour of Shadows, a lot of the drama of the story hinges on the one moment when the aunt of the central character does not act tactfully, and she betrays to him the fact that she disapproves of his gay lifestyle unknowingly, because she is hard of hearing and hard of sight, and she thinks she's talking to an old friend.
Yes, that's right.
And this is a decisive moment in their relationship. Can we just talk, not tactful.
Talk us through some of the stories. 1-1 is about a son who regrets that he didn't have more contact with his dead mother, and also regrets the fact that she really didn't want him. 1-1.
This is the lead story in the anthology, so it's the story that introduces you to the major, I suppose you'd say, the kind of principal subject matter. And it's a story, it's a narrator talking to someone who's identified as you, clearly someone with whom this narrator has had a relationship, but the person is never fully identified. And he's retelling the story of his mother's death 6 years previously. And it's a story about the way in which he had been abandoned by his mother as a young child, and then how, in a sense, he had abandoned her, how he's living with this regret, and how he perceives Ireland also. He says at one point that he doesn't believe in God or in Ireland.
Yeah, there's some very, very observant pieces about the Irish at JFK. The Irish have a way of moving warily through a public space that is definably Irish, of a raw, almost resentful stare into the middle distance. Do you think there's something to that?
The certain demeanour of young men standing in a queue at the airport, and how that helps him to kind of feel at home, or that he's going home. But that story, 1-1, also has some very interesting observations on touch or the lack of it. I mean, when his mother dies eventually, he and his brother and sister are there at the bedside, and as she passes away, they get up one by one and touch her on the forehead. That is the only touch between them, with their hands or their fingers on her forehead.
Yeah.
And one of the emptinesses in this family appears to have been the emptiness, the absence of intimacy, the absence of touch.
He says, we walked down the corridor as after she died, as though for the rest of our lives our own breathing would bear the traces of the end of hers, of her final struggle, as though our own way of being in the world had just been halved or quartered by what we'd seen.
The great loss in that story is, I think, compounded or informed by the fact that, as Julia said, he is speaking, he is telling the story to another, to you, you who knew him, you who was a lover, probably. And so the loss of the two become intertwined, the two losses.
The Empty Family, with the title story, what did you make of it, Julia?
It's an interesting story, as you said earlier. It's more reflective.
Yes,
it's almost a kind of a mood piece.
And almost a companion piece to the
It's quite different, isn't it, in tone, in feel, to the other stories? I mean,
except that, yes, that's right, except that like 1-1, it is spoken to to an other, to this you again, who had been in a relationship with the narrator.
Yeah, I think in many respects those two stories are quite similar, that they deal with very similar kind of situations of a central character who has been living in North America, in one case in New York and Texas, in the other case in San Francisco. And except in this story, the narrator has retained a home or a place, a house, let's say, in Ireland. And the focus is very much on how this house, in a sense, is not a home. We're told at one point, home is an empty house, and then no, home isn't that. Home is some graves outside of Enniscorthy, except he can't put his furniture and his paintings there.
Home was some graves where my dead lay. That's but also, I mean, the sense of, you know, he moves on to things about language and the fact that language can't match the chaotic nature of reality and so on. It has that kind of reflection that tends not to occur in the other stories.
That's true, and that it's interesting in the sense that that's actually the passage that kind of ends the story, the passage about language. And it's a shift in prose. There's a kind of movement, and it's something which is characteristic of a lot of realist fiction now also, that there is a movement away from realistic detail into a kind of lyrical prose reflecting on
language.
I mean,
he says that he was looking forward to focusing on a piece of the world indifferent to the fact that there's language, that there are names to describe things, that kind of idea.
That's right.
But that story, did it work for you, the Empty Family, Morrison?
It did, in the way that you described it earlier, as a series of
meditations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much. And as I say, as a kind of a complement or a companion piece to the first story in the volume.
Yes, something totally
about them that they echoed off each other for me.
Another story, The Straddles, the two places, two women. And this is an Irish woman set designer. She returns from America to work on a film, and she meets the widow of her former lover.
I found this story weaker, I think, than some of the other ones. I didn't find her entirely credible as a character, although the situation was much the same. Yeah. She's someone coming back to Ireland. She finds it a grey and empty place, and her central relationship now seems to be a very muted relationship, barely a relationship at all, really, with a Guatemalan couple who she provides with a house and who look after her needs.
It's certainly more constructed as a story on the basis through events, shall
plot,
we say,
plot
through
driven,
plot and some of the other stories in the piece. Yeah.
Also, it struck me that it has a remarkably benevolent conclusion after all the bitchiness we witnessed right through it. You know, there is a kind of asymmetry in that.
Well, that may be part of the problem with the credibility of it for me, I think.
Yeah, I see.
Well, she is painted as something of a harridan, this character.
And she does paint herself up for that final scene, too. She meets with, this is a woman, the central character is a woman who's between 75 and 80, I believe, who meets up with the woman who married her former lover. The great love of her life. And if she was capable of having a great love of her life. But she paints herself up for this. She goes out to the car and she puts on all kinds of makeup.
The Pearl Fishers, three people who've been at school together, meet in a restaurant, a married couple and another man. And the husband, Dunnaker, is terrified that his wife, Gronje, will find out he had an affair with the other man many years ago at school. That story, The Pearl Fishers,
The one we were talking about previously, Two Women, it had some wonderful one-liners in it. And The Pearl Fishers takes that a stage further. It's a funny story. And in fact, it occurred to me that it's surprising that Colin Tobin doesn't write more comic stories. I mean, he can be quite scabrous in his wit in some of his non-fiction. But we don't see much of it in his fiction, and perhaps we should, because some of this story is very, very funny in places, where the three characters meet in a restaurant, in the Clarence, I think it is, and Bono has been there earlier. He was spotted in the lobby, and one of the characters indeed as a journalist who has just written a book called Reading the Bible with Bono.
I wonder who that journalist is.
Indeed, this story does prompt quite a lot of mischievous speculation.
That's unfair to Thobin to even think that he would base a character on someone that... Patrick Moorhouse, who's a priest theologian back from America. Let's talk about him. Grainne wants to speak the truth about him, that looking back on their lives, that he came on to her in some way, or they had an affair. What did you make of that?
I thought this was one of the strongest stories in the collection, and I enjoyed it very much. And I thought that it was a wonderful coming-of-age story about the two boys in school and the relationship that developed between them. The focus here is on the kind of corruption within the church and the whole subject of sexual abuse. But it's handled in a very interesting way.
Yes, I mean, forgive me, the paedophilia episode is almost treated as an aside in the context of what goes on. I mean, one of the clerical paedophiles. But talk to
us about... Yes, because the relationships between the three, between the Donica and Grainne and the narrator, the main character, they are by far the most...
but there was a reference to a paedophile priest. I'm saying it's done in a kind of throwaway style, as if it's just taken as part of the total landscape. But I want to hear you talk about Patrick Moorhouse, this priest theologian that was fancied by the young student, as he was in the seminary, and he seems different. He's been in abroad, and he has a line in language and in talk about religion and literature that appeals to the young lad. What did you make of him?
Well, he's a kind of a character very much out of that time period, I suppose. Who one of the interesting things about the story is that the narrator of the story says that he discovers kind of sex and religion at the same time, and that this may seem paradoxical. It's part of the humour of this story too. And he finds himself going to meet with Moorhouse, and Moorhouse is advising him on his reading and meeting with groups of students, Grainne included amongst them. And one of the things that's interesting is that this is the man who turns out to be the abuser. but in fact, the narrator never had any inkling or thought even that something like this might occur, whereas in fact we discovered that it was going on around him without his being aware of it.
And he realises in retrospect, or at least he thinks in retrospect, that it was sexually charged for him as well.
Two stories dealing with sex in Spain, Barcelona and the street. In Barcelona, there's a gay orgy with 20 people. What did you make of that, Morris?
I thought, again, there's some lovely humour in it. At one stage, referring to this orgy in Barcelona, the narrator says, "No one that night was drunk, and there was no alcohol in the flat, which surprised me. In Ireland, where an orgy to take place, and this was unimaginable in 1975, then everyone would have had to get drunk first and begin by pretending it was not happening."
Yeah, he learns that when you go to an orgy in Barcelona in 1975, that you have to play by the rules, and that he thought it was going to be all freedom, but that the orgy has its own etiquette.
Yes.
There's also a kind of unvarnished realism.
Yes, there are some very frank descriptions of sex, of gay sex. And I mean, that's a striking feature of the volume, or at least it will be for some people.
With the street is much more tender story in terms of gay sex. What did you make of it?
It's one of two stories set in Barcelona. We've just been talking about one of them, Barcelona 1975, the one which has the orgy or orgies in it, and that's very much a story about the young man coming out, finding himself in Barcelona in the mid-1970s. The street is utterly different.
Yeah, let me just fill in just the listeners on the street. It's an affair between Malik, who's a young Pakistani immigrant, and an older man, Abdul, who turns out to be married.
Yes, so whereas Barcelona 1975 has this young man finding himself coming out sexually into, as he describes it at the end, the shining city that is Barcelona. In other words, a young Western man finding him, discovering his identity, you know, in a glorious Western city. Here you have the street dealing with the Pakistani immigrant community in Barcelona. And in fact, it need not be in Barcelona. It could be anywhere, actually. The street could be any street in any city. The community could be almost any migrant community in any city. And the story wonderfully deals with both the whole political dimension of that, of immigration, of the compromising situations, of the abuse of these young people, the fact that they've forfeit their passports to their own countrymen, and it is men mostly, when they arrive in these places, and therefore they're utterly constrained in what they can do. But it deals with that as well as dealing with a wonderfully tender love story about the relationship between the young man and the older man.
That story seems to work very well, Julia.
I think it's probably the story, for me, is the strongest story in the collection. It's not really a story, it's almost a novella. It's quite long. But one of the things that Tobin does in this story is that he fuses the kind of meditative quality almost that he has in the other stories, because it's very focused on the character of Malik, his state of anxiety, his fear, his vulnerability. So the narration catches the emotional frame of mind of the character at the same time that it provides a very kind of realistic setting and story and detail. And the merging of those two works extremely well
it's
here.
It's utterly believable.
I mean, it's
quite
completely
the imagination for Tobin, one would think, but it is utterly believable.
This is an amazing piece of work. There's also, you're back to family again, where Abdul, the older man, says, "I said to the younger boy that my real family is you." That's after he's discovered that the older man is married.
With children.
The other Spanish story is about a woman returning, a former communist agitator, returns to Spain after 8 years in London.
Well, this is a story about Karma, I think that's the way you pronounce her name, who's been away for 8 years and who returns home to quote-unquote the new Spain. Again, it's focused on the idea of exile and return, and the central focus again is on a house. This time it's a house which she and her sister have inherited from her grandmother, and she's someone who in a sense is aggressively reclaiming her home place, which she sees as having been destroyed by the greed of her father, and as it turns out, also
there's a sense in which the story lost its way a bit in the pub crawl with the two men. I don't know if you had that feeling about it, or you felt that was more integrated.
Well, it perhaps could have been sharper in that regard. She's not a very pleasant character, really, and that could be said of a number of the central characters in this collection, of course. But
nor is the mother.
Nor is the mother. No, and indeed, this is a family. I mean, the emptiness in this family is that it is bereft of any real affection between any of its members.
There are a number of scenes in the stories, also in the street, of brutality. In the street, there is a kind of scene where Malik is beaten up by Baldy after the two men have been discovered in a sexual encounter. Here, there's also kind of quite a degree of brutality where Karma attacks her father at the dinner table and tells him that he's grown fat selling our property, and where she then comes home later in the evening and kicks the refrigerator, which her mother has tied up with a lock and key so she can't get into it.
It's interesting. I was just thinking that both Spain and Ireland are the two countries in Europe that have had the biggest property disasters, the biggest crashes in both countries.
Yes, that is explicitly referred to in one of the stories where Icarus is invoked to capture precisely that.
An element of accident there, of course, in that just happens to have been a country where Tobin spent a good deal of time and perhaps still does. The Colour of Shadows, which you referred to earlier, Morris, Paul's aunt Josie in Enniscorthy is taken to hospital, thereafter to a nursing home, and the aunt raised Paul in the absence of his alcoholic mother.
It's a story in which there's a kind of a family secret, and the story of the mother has been kept from Paul. I mean, the principal line of this story is the way in which he attends to his dying aunt, but hidden away is the story of him and his mother. One of the things that I find interesting here, and indeed about several of the other Irish stories, is that it ends in such an anti-sentimental way. And that it ends with the death of the aunt, and also with the discovery that his mother has returned, another kind of exile and return story, has returned back to the community, that he had never known about this, that the aunt's death has created a space for him. But in fact, it may be a space that he's not going to do anything.
Some terrific observation of that story, isn't there?
It is marvellous. And Julia just referred to the the space that, that his aunt's death creates, but that he may or may not use. And there is a wonderful suspense right at the end of the story where you are left wondering, what will he do with this? What can he do with this? He has promised his dying aunt that he won't see his mother because there was such a ill will between them. And yet you are left wondering. It's beautifully written, the final paragraph, where you're left wondering what, if anything, will he do with this space?
And you have something similar in 1-1, the opening story, where after the death of the mother, he says that it's too late for everything, the communication which was lost between them. And then he says, but he's almost relieved that it is too late. So still drawing back into that silence.
As you were saying, he's a writer in motion all the time, isn't he, between places.
Yes, very much so.
Again, the there's a lot of equivocation, prevarication. The quote in the passage we heard right at the start seems to capture so much of it. All movement, all spillage, but pure containment as well. That could be said of some of the characters.
That could be said of some of the writing in the story too, you know. Yes. That. But the collection moves, in a sense, towards happier endings. Yeah. And I don't know if it's coincidental that, in a sense, they seem to happen outside of Ireland. But certainly in the street, the final section of the two men walking along the seafront is seen in a very positive kind of way. And indeed, in the New Spain, Karma, alone in the empty house, is not like the character in Empty Family.
That's right. And Barcelona, 1975, he walks out into the shining
and
city.
And into his freedom. Yes.
I noticed that Tobin has been teaching a bit in recent years. It'll be interesting to see if that, if we see that in the stories, that the reflection of that particular side of his life for Morris.
Yes, well, there is a reference in at least one of the stories to the fact that the character, that the narrator is a teacher, in 1-1, in fact. Yeah. And possibly
that's
in
right.
the Empty Family as well.
Yes, and gives the sofa that he buys in Bloomingdale's to one of his students.
So. We've been discussing The Empty Family by Colm Thobin, published by Viking. My thanks to Morris Devlin and Julia Carlson. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.